Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. The Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies joins with the entire Jewish people in mourning the unspeakably tragic deaths of Naftali Frankel, may his memory be a blessing, Gilad Shaar, may his memory be a blessing, and Eyal Yifrach, may his memory be a blessing. Words cannot adequately express our collective sadness at this senseless loss. May the families find comfort and consolation among all the mourners of Zion and Yerushalayim. This week, a reprise podcast on Balak by Rabbi Meir Schweiger. He recorded the podcast in 2007. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Mashgiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Today I would like to examine the blessings which Bilam gave to the Jewish people, and in particular to focus on the first blessing. Let me preface this by saying, Balak wanted Bilam to curse the Jewish people. Balak took Bilam to three different places from which Bilam was to view the Jewish people from three different angles, to be able to somehow locate a weakness, a vulnerability, on which to latch his curse. According to Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, the three places that Bilam is taken to is Bamot Baal, Stei Tzofim, Rosh HaPa'or. Bamot Baal, which appears in chapter 22, verse 41, is the place where Bilam is to examine the material aspect of the Jewish people, to somehow find their soft spot materially. The next place that he's taken, in chapter 23, verse 14, Steito Tzofim. Tzofim are the seers, the prophets, the visionaries. Bilam is to examine the Jewish people in terms of their spirituality, intellectuality, their vision. Perhaps there we can find something lacking. And the last place which Bilam is taken is Rosh HaPa'or, chapter 23, verse 28. Pa'or was the god of immorality, lewdness, coarseness. Bilam was to examine the morality of the Jewish people, specifically their sexuality, to see if there was any defect, any soft spot, which could once again be used for the purpose of cursing them. Today I would like to focus on the first blessing, the material one. This is chapter 23, verse 9. Bilam says, from the top of the Tzurim, which normally are understood as firm rocks, Unkelus, the Aramaic translation, says this refers to mountains. But perhaps these are mountains, which are very, very strong mountains, made of rocks that are hard, old, seasoned. So Bilam says, I see them from the tops of the mountains. From the hills I look out to them. There are people that dwell alone, and among the nations they are not counted. Yitchashav perhaps is better understood, as they are not mentioned, recognized. But Yitchashav is reflexive, which perhaps is even better translated is, they do not consider themselves. Rashi quotes a rabbinic comment which says, the mountains refer to the patriarchs, the hills to the matriarchs. Bilam looks at the foundation of the Jewish people, And he sees that foundation being very solid, very tall, a very powerful image. But that foundation should be connected with the second part of the Pasuk, the idea of a people who dwell by themselves, who do not consider themselves to be part of the nations. Perhaps the most striking model of this is Abraham. Abraham and Sarah, who were told Lech Lecha, who detach themselves from their homeland, who never become integrated, so to speak, among the nations of their new homeland, who move to the land of Israel, but are always separate, alone, and do not seek to be assimilated in their surroundings. From the very outset, the Jewish people separate themselves. They're not looking to stand out. They're looking to be separate. I would like to emphasize the element of humility in this approach. The Jewish people are not looking to wow the world at large. Perhaps the world at large is very impressed with material success, and the Jewish people play that down. They're not interested in keeping up, some people would say, with the Joneses. Unfortunately, it's come to be with the Schwartzes. The Jewish people don't have to be on the Forbes 500 list or 100 list. It is somehow very important to us to be able to preserve our unique identity. And that is rooted in Abraham and Sarah. In chapter 14 of Genesis, Abraham is referred to as Avram HaIvri, the Hebrew. And the rabbis say, what does it mean, HaIvri? It has to do with the idea of Ever HaNahar, the side of the river. He is the one who comes from the other side of the river. We'd say from the other side of the tracks. In many ways, Ivri is seen as a pejorative term. The other. The other in the sense of someone inferior. Someone who is not impressive. And Avraham maintains that identity. He's not looking to flaunt it. When we look at the next pasuk, which says, who counts, or who will count, the dust of Jacob? The number of Israel's seed. May my soul die the death of the straight, upright ones, and may my end be like them. In Genesis, God tells Abraham, I will bless your children. They will be like the dust of the earth. And it's usually understood to mean they will be as numerous as the dust of the earth. And one could see that in the blessing of Bilam. Who can count the dust? But perhaps what is a deeper meaning of this verse is that dust is something which is not impressive. Dust is something you trample on. And yet nevertheless, it's still there. No matter how many times you step on it, you'll still have that dust. In and of itself, dust is not impressive. But maybe the awesomeness is its capacity to survive. And that may be the reason why we speak here of the dust of Jacob. Jacob is always associated with that aspect of the Jewish people that is struggling to survive. And maybe this is what is so amazing, that somehow the Jewish people, no matter how much they are persecuted, continue to exist. And no matter how few we may be, we continue to make an impact. The idea of the number of Israel seeds, rova, related to the word rivi'ah, which is to impregnate, perhaps is looking at the idea of the Jewish people who are future-oriented. Perhaps a very interesting contrast in this pasuk. In Genesis, God says to Adam, "For you are dust, and to dust you shall return." Dust is very often associated with an imagery of death, something lacking vitality. Rova is the sperm that is the source, but not only the source, the hope for life. And maybe this is what makes the Jewish people so fascinating, such a riddle. When it seems that the Jewish people are about to be exterminated, somehow they regenerate themselves. They have this capacity to bring themselves back to life. Everything which I'm saying relates to a theme that I've discussed on a number of occasions, that the Jewish people cannot be measured quantitatively, rather qualitatively. We cannot be reduced to being a number, but somehow our impact goes far beyond the numbers. Hence what Bilam sees when he looks at the material aspect of the Jewish people is that you can't measure them materially, because there's a certain quality which they have which makes them unique, distinct, which is always future-oriented, that enables them to overcome every situation. I would now like to focus on the end of Pasuk Yud, 23:10. When Bilam says, "Let me die the death of the upright," there is a rabbinic comment which appears in the tractate Avodah Zarah, 25a. Rabbi Yochanan said, this is referring to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They are the ones who are the upright. And in effect, what Bilam is saying is, I would like to die their death. I would like my end to be like them. He's not only asking to die like them. What he's in effect saying is, I wish that I could live like them, that my death, which is the culmination of my life, could be the same as theirs. In a previous podcast, I mentioned the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin in the mid to late 1800s, who wrote a commentary on the Torah known as Ha'amek Davar, going into the depth of the matter. In his introduction to the book of Bereishit, Genesis, he says that this book is referred to in the prophets as the book of the upright, Sefer Hayashar. And then he quotes the rabbinic comment on our verse. Why is it called Sefer Hayashar? Because it is the book of Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, who are known as the upright ones. And the Netziv in his commentary raises a very interesting question. If we for the moment accept this rabbinic comment that the upright ones are Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, why does Bilam refer to them as the upright? Why not refer to them as the righteous ones, as the pious ones? What is so special about this term, the upright, to the point where Bilam sees this as being the essence of who the patriarchs were? The Netziv makes a very interesting distinction between righteous and upright. And I will paraphrase what he says. Righteous may very well have to do with the idea of somebody who lives up to a certain standard, who is accountable to that standard. The idea that God has created expectations of a certain type of lifestyle, and being righteous means that I aspire to raise the bar, to maximize my human potential, to create a level of existence which is above and beyond anything around me. That is a tzaddik. What is yashar? Yashar means straight, upright, in the sense, according to the Netziv, of someone who is concerned with the existence of the world. Perhaps I would say the continuing existence of the world. And what the Netziv notes is that very often, being a tzaddik and being yashar are in conflict with each other. And the Netziv actually quotes a verse from Deuteronomy, Parshat Ha'azinu, Moshe's legacy to the Jewish people, the song which he leaves them with. This is to be found in chapter 34, verse 4. The verse is, God is a rock. His work is perfect. All of his ways are just. A faithful God without any perversion. Righteous and upright. And the next verse, is corruption his? No. The defect is with his sons. A generation which is stubborn and convoluted. And the Netziv says, God is referred to as being both upright and just. And what is this verse referring to? And he says something which is a very chilling thought. The verse is coming to somehow justify, exonerate God's punishment of the Jewish people in the Second Temple period, the destruction of the Second Temple. And the Netziv says the following. Why is it that the Jewish people were destroyed in the Second Temple period? We know that in the First Temple period, from the books of the prophets, that Jews were violating the cardinal sins of Judaism. They were steeped in idolatry. There was sexual immorality. Murder. This is clear from reading all the prophets. So that it is understandable that God brought about the destruction of the first commonwealth, of the temple. But in the second temple period, there was this unbelievable growth in religiosity. This is the rabbinic period when the oral law is being systematized, is being developed, when people are studying, to use the words of the Netziv, in the Second Temple period, the people were righteous, they were pious, they toiled in the study of Torah. So what was wrong? And the answer that he gives is, they were not upright. And he goes on to say, because of the hatred, unbridled hatred in their hearts of each other, their suspicion of anybody who would not act according to their perception of what fear of God was, where they would brand them a Sadducee, a heretic, label people, not only label them, but in an extreme situation, even come to bloodshed and to all the evils of the world. This is why God destroyed the Second Commonwealth. Because God is upright. God does not tolerate righteous people like this. Even though these are people who held themselves accountable to a higher standard of behavior, who sought religiosity, even though in their quote-unquote witch hunting, in their suspicions, they were motivated by their love and fear of God, doing it for the sake of heaven. But what they were lacking was being upright, being concerned about the continued existence of the reality of their fellow people. The principle became more important than the person. The extremism, the zealotry, self-righteousness was found to be unbearable by God. And the Netziv goes on to say a fascinating comment. The patriarchs were all righteous. The patriarchs held themselves accountable to a very high standard of behavior. They were fully aware of who their surroundings were and of the lack in their moral standards. And yet, nevertheless, the patriarchs were yashar. They did not seek the destruction of the world around them, but rather they sought their well-being. Abraham, when he's told by God that God is about to destroy Sodom, prays on behalf of the people of Sodom. Give them another chance. Perhaps there still is a possibility of changing. Isaac, when he's expelled from the land of the Philistines in chapter 26, and he's subsequently approached by Avimelech the king, and even says to him, "Why have you come? You hate me." And Avimelech says, "I'd like to make a pact with you." And Yitzchak immediately sits down, eats and drinks with him, sends him away in peace. Jacob is abused by Laban, and yet Jacob in the end makes a pact with Laban. Although the patriarchs have every reason to hate these various peoples, to see how their lifestyles are totally inimical to everything which they believe in, where they could very easily pray for their demise, they are upright. They do not seek the destruction of the world. And that is the quality of God. God is not only righteous, God is also upright. Bilam sees this quality as perhaps being the quality which he is lacking. As I mentioned in last year's podcast, Bilam, who is a prophet, who is a very articulate man of vision, certainly knows that the Jewish people are the chosen ones of God. But even if they weren't, how could he now be seeking out their destruction? How could he be assisting Balak? How could he not be somehow negotiating for some sort of settlement to bring about some sort of peaceful resolution? Bilam is not yashar. And even if I were to assume, which the rabbis clearly don't, that Bilam is a tzaddik, but that's not ultimately the reason for his downfall. His downfall is because he is prepared to see the Jewish people be slaughtered en masse because of jealousy, because of power. This is what separates the patriarchs from Bilam. This is what Bilam sees as being so special about them. If I now take the whole blessing, the patriarchs on the one hand are not looking to be assimilated among the world. They dwell by themselves. They are not seeking that approbation of the global community. And yet at the same time, they are yashar. They care about the world. They may condemn what the rest of the world is doing, but they don't condemn the people. They don't seek their destruction. This is a very, very important lesson for all of us. I said earlier that the Netziv is very chilling, because in many ways, the reality which he describes of the Second Temple period is very similar to a reality which we have nowadays. And perhaps this is a red light to all of us. The more that we aspire towards a higher standard of behavior, the more that we want to be righteous, we have to at the same time be upright. Righteousness can sometimes lead to arrogance. It can be self-righteous. It can lead to power or a craving for power. If the righteousness is to be a righteousness that is loved by God, it has to be balanced by being upright. Righteousness can create majesty, as I mentioned earlier. By aspiring to a higher standard, I maximize my divine image. And in doing so, I become majestic. But that majesty has to always be tempered by humility, by being upright, by recognizing that I am part of a larger framework, that I need that larger framework, that larger framework is the creation of God, and that I should respect it. Bilam sees this as being the bedrock of the Jewish people. Perhaps we need to learn that sense of humility, to not have to stand out, to not have to flaunt it, to be able to do that which is right, and even if we don't get that recognition, to nevertheless persist, because that is the right thing to do. Isaac is expelled by Avimelech when he becomes so successful. He was not interested in flaunting his success, but the king is jealous. Isaac accepts it and ultimately is able to reach a reconciliation with the king, because the king sees that his success is ultimately everyone's success. May we learn this lesson, and may the third commonwealth continue to exist, because we know how to balance that dialectic of being tzaddik and yashar. Shabbat shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.